This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
At the Clinton Street Theater at 7 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm/kboofilms.
Andy Warhol, let's just scream. Hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
This is Joseph Gallivan on Art Focus, KBOO's art show, standing in for Ava Lake. My guest today is Christopher Rauschenberg, whose latest photographs are on show at the Elizabeth Leach Gallery until February the 2nd. And there's also a show of his father, Robert Rauschenberg's prints, which is on show until March the 2nd. Welcome, Christopher.
Oh, it's good to be here.
These are pictures you took in the Hermitage Museum in Leningrad?
Yeah, it's now called St. Petersburg. And they downgraded Lenin.
And also at the Russian Museum in same city.
Also in St. Petersburg.
Yeah. Just tell me what people will see when they go into the gallery.
Well, there's a mixture. There's some assembled panoramic photographs that are not 360 degrees, but a couple of them are close to that. That show the grand staircase coming into the museum and a sculpture hall downstairs and an all-gold room and an all-red ornate sort of throne room. But then there's also pictures that have like hands and feet that are in paintings and statues and kind of the relationship between the painted and sculpted reality and the museum environment itself.
Mm-hmm. So in one, there is a picture of a foot the bottom of a painting, which is cropped, and then below it is a gold chair back.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we're used to, when we go into a museum, we either sink into the world that's within the artworks. If you look at a painting of a crucifixion, you're either thinking about the crucifixion or you're thinking about the fact that you're in a museum, but you're not thinking about the fact that the crucifixion is in a museum, you know, mm-hmm. that this guy is nailed to a wall that also has brocade and gold, you know.
Right.
So that's what I'm interested in with the show, is to really kind of think about how are these two realities interpenetrating of the physical reality of the room that you're in and then also the depicted realities.
Mm-hmm. Another of the pictures shows a sort of gold scroll. It looked like two waves.
Yeah.
Like they look like the tsunami sign you see at the coast. And then below that is what is below that?
There's these two hands that look, they're sort of reaching out, and they look like maybe they're in distress or something like that. It's from a long hallway that's a replica of a hallway at the Vatican that the Tsar sent his painters off to study this grand room of the Vatican and replicate it in his palace. And that motif of these sort of wave, sort of spiral-like wave forms, it runs along the whole thing. And where those two hands were, I thought it made an interesting conversation between the waves and the hands. And you know, all up and down the wall, there were various other things interacting with them, but I thought that was the most interesting.
Mm-hmm. And you were thinking in terms of words as well, like are the waves inundating the person with the hands? Is that part of your process?
Well, I tend to believe that as a photographer, you go around and you have sort of like a little internal Geiger counter that you walk into some place and the needle moves. And you know there's something invisible there that has a force, like radioactivity. That there's something in this room that would make a good picture. And I don't tend to respond to things intellectually. I tend to respond more intuitively that way, where I start to go, oh, well, wait a minute. There's something about that that's really compelling. And I'll take a picture of it, and later I'll put it into words what it was.
Right.
But,
Another picture shows a sort of classical nude statue, and then there's a kind of a guy cleaning the windows or something on the outside. Why did you take that picture of the two forms?
Well, I love the fact that there were these two beings dancing together, neither of which were aware of the other, because the guy who's on the outside of the window, working on the window, he's not paying any attention. I don't think he can even see the sculpture that's inside. And, of course, the sculpture can't see anything.
Right.
It's not actually alive. And yet they were the sculpture is reaching out and toward him in this interesting way, and he's leaning in a funny way. And I just felt like the sort of the dance of their gestures was really good. And normally, almost all the pictures in the show, I just shot them once. I don't. Like, I'm not going to shoot a whole roll of that foot in the statue, you know?
Right.
But that one, I actually took four or five pictures. I was like, oh, that's, now he's leaning this way.
Because of the movement.
And then there's some other guys sort of walking by behind him. And would I like that, or do I want just one man and one sculpture? You know, I think just one man. So that one, I actually sat through a longer performance shooting a few.
You have a series called Daily Life, which people can look at on your website. ChristopherAuschenberg.com, and where you just carry a small point and shoot and take pictures of things that trigger your Geiger counter.
Yeah, I have it in my pocket now. I might take a picture of that tape dispenser over there.
This place is old school. You got some good analog stuff to look at. But you took the biggest pictures in the Elizabeth Leach Gallery are multiple shots juxtaposed, like a panorama that a tourist would take when they stand still and they move slightly and take eight pictures in a row.
Yeah.
And they're framed and they're matted in a way that shows they are individual. So the mat kind of zigzags up and down. Mm-hmm. Just tell me about the effect, what you were going for, particularly when you took one of the Grand Staircase.
Well, I got a panorama camera many years ago. As I like the idea of showing if my central belief that drives my photography is that the world is really interesting, you should pay attention to it. That if I use a camera to say, look, one square inch of the world is really interesting, that's not as powerful as saying, look, 140 degrees of the world is really interesting. So I was using a Wide-Lux panorama camera. It shoots a 140 degree angle. And then at one point we went to our favorite beach on the Oregon coast, and I just wanted a picture of the whole place and how it was around me. Mm-hmm. So I took a nearly 360 degree panorama, not with the Wide-Lux camera, but with my regular camera, just shooting and then take a next shot that lines up with the edge of the first one, and then another one that lines up with the edge of that one, so that when you fit them together, it'll make a continuous scene. And I just did that for myself, really. And then I looked at it once I got home and printed it in the darkroom and put them together, I went, this is really interesting. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't just do this for myself. I should do this as my art. You know? So I've been doing those kind of put-together panoramas for quite a while now. And it comes in very handy in a lot of ways, one of which is that the picture that I have of the Grand Staircase at the Hermitage, for example, there's people going up and down that staircase continuously. I mean, mm-hmm. there is never a moment that you could have shot in one shot the picture that I ended up with by putting together eight sub-pictures of it.
Mm-hmm. And just tell the listeners who is in the picture that they will see.
There's one man standing. It's the staircase kind of comes up and branches out and makes a sort of a T. And it's, it's this red carpet staircase and amazing marble figures and gold filigree and mm-hmm. statues from the waist up leaning in over people's heads who are actually going up and down the stairs. It's a very ornate, wild thing with skylights all around it. And in the picture, there's a man who is standing on one of the landings posing for somebody else photographing him. Mm-hmm. And I was waiting for him to go away, and I realized, actually, I kind of like him there because he's standing underneath one of the marble statues right mm-hmm. above him, and it made a nice comparison. And then I went around carefully each time, waiting until everybody went away. And then way off in the distance at the other end of that T of that staircase, there's somebody else posing for a picture and standing still a long time, but she's very far away and small. And I thought, actually, that's kind of nice. The scale of that kind of integrates in a nice way. I'll go ahead and shoot it with her in it. And then all the way around in the last panel is looking down a long hallway. It makes a very deep sort of tunnel going off the edge of the frame, and there's a person walking up that, and I realized actually that was good. I was waiting for there to be nobody in that hallway, and it's a long hallway, so I was there quite a while. And then this one person was in really a good spot, and I thought, okay, I'm going to shoot now. Right. This is it. You know?
And the effect is of it's kind of like being in an ant colony. You know, you're looking down different corridors at the same time. You know, everything is sort of spread out around you. Could you say a bit about your thinking about the way a photograph can make you see the world differently?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I like about a photograph is that the camera teaches you early on that you don't only record the thing that you're interested in. If I see my introduction to this was I was in England when I was a teenager, and I made a photograph of the changing of the guard at Buckingham Palace. And I got home and I got my film developed, and I got a little print that didn't seem to be the changing of the guard. It seemed to be the backs of a bunch of people's heads with some stuff way off in the foreground, in the background. And I sort of realized from that, oh, well, the camera, your brain says, don't pay attention to any of this other stuff. Only look at the important thing, and I'll tell you what that is. But the camera doesn't do that. The camera, if you've got Henry Kissinger and a chow dog, you might think Henry Kissinger is important. The person next to you might think the chow dog is important. But the camera doesn't have any agenda that way, one way or the other. It's going to photograph everything the same. And if the dog is closer to the camera, he's going to take over the picture. And that you have to kind of learn to kind of record the whole scene at once in a way that has a visual simplicity and logic and pleasure, and then let the viewer kind of go through and decide, are they more interested in Henry Kissinger? Are they more interested in the dog? Are they interested in this guy standing on the stairs? Are they interested in the sculptures? Are they interested in the red carpet or being able to look down the tunnel? So I'm making the viewer become an active explorer.
Mm-hmm. And also, you talk about the way a photograph can capture a moment in time.
Yeah.
So when you're in this old palace, you're looking at details that may have come and gone, or they may be incorrect.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the essential nature of photography that it rips an instant out of the continuum of time and saves it. And things that normally would be gone, you missed it. You know, if you think about going to a dance concert, if you're busy that night, you missed it. There's nothing you can do. You can't see it. Except if there's photography or photography's child film and video, maybe you haven't missed it, because maybe that performance has been ripped out of the continuum of time and saved, and you can see it later. I mean, we don't know what Sarah Bernhardt performances were like, but we sure know what Lauren Bacall's performances were like. They were recorded.
And when photography began, what were the first two things that people did?
Well, the first two main uses for photography was to photograph the members of your family. I mean, it was, normally people would have these painted portraits, but that was only for really rich people. If you weren't really rich, you couldn't afford to have a portrait painter do this thing. So suddenly you could have this record of grandma, and your grandchildren could know what your grandma looked like, which had never been true in the history of photography before. But also, when photography was invented, right away people went rushing off to Egypt and to places, exotic places like this, photographed the Sphinx and the pyramids and brought the pictures back to England and France and said, look at this. So photography had this sort of dual job. Its sort of main job was triumphing over time, the tyranny of time. And its second job was triumphing over the tyranny of space, where, we know what the Earth looks like from outer space. We know this because we've seen photographs of it. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we would never know it.
This is Joseph Gallivan on KBOO's Art Focus. I'm talking to Christopher Rauschenberg. His latest photographs are at the Elizabeth Leach Gallery until February the 2nd, and some prints by his father, Robert Rauschenberg, are there at the same gallery until March the 2nd. You've been a photographer all your life, so you must have clocked up a lot of hours in the darkroom, and now these days, I guess, hunched over a Apple computer.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, my mom taught me how to make darkroom prints when I was 6 years old.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, what do you listen to while you're working, when not taking pictures but doing the, what do you call it, the darkroom work?
Yeah, my darkroom work is not in a very dark room anymore. It's on a computer. But yeah, I always like to listen to a sort of a crazy mixture. I have, as soon as CDs came out, I got a CD player that could shuffle 300 CDs at once. And I love that. And, you know, nowadays with iPods and all that, you put them on shuffle and you can hear your whole collection mixed in together. But what I brought today is something that I really like that has a Russian base. It's called the Black Slavics. Mm-hmm. And it's this German musician decided to say, well, since African slaves completely changed American music when they were brought over to the plantations here, what would happen if the Russian plantation owners had brought in African slaves? What would have happened to Russian music? So it's a band from Cameroon, and they're singing traditional Russian songs that get more and more African as the cut continues.
Okay, this is the Black Slavics, and this track is called Mboka.
Boka siya bo moye sila kate Esika moye kokenda naliwa Lelo nkolo mboka boko ye banga Bisunyo
That was Mboka by the Black Slavics. I'm talking to Christopher Rauschenberg, and that's the music he listens to, one of the types of music he listens to while he's doing his darkroom work. Christopher, what effect does music have on the way you work?
Well, I think, I mean, for me, my poor wife is used to me playing music all the time. She's like, oh, can't we just have no music for a minute, you know? But for me, it's sort of part of my sort of seeing the world around me as being sort of full of wonderful stimuli, sort of wonderful visual stimuli. I was saying, you know, anywhere you are, each of you listeners, if you look around you, there's an infinite number of things that you could be photographing that are in the room with you right now or in the world with you right now if you're outdoors. And somehow having music in the air and having it be changing all the time is some kind of a balance for that, is some kind of corollary to that, and mm-hmm. it makes me feel more alive to have music.
You mean the visual stimulation is too much, so it's actually tempered by music?
It's not so much tempered, it's that it's too much and I like it being too much, and let's have it be even more too much by adding some music to it too.
Oh, okay.
But I think, you know, it's the visual thing. It's interesting because there's, even though there's an infinite number of things that you could notice, one rarely notices very many things around oneself. And mm-hmm. and what you really learn when you're trained to be a photographer, it's not to learn how to make prints in the darkroom. It's to learn how to notice what's going on around you, the things that your brain is not telling you are important, but that you would, if you can, slow yourself down enough to pay attention to them, then you notice they're really cool. I always describe the right headspace to be as a photographer as being like a kid at a grown-up dinner party, mm-hmm. where it's like everybody's talking about some stuff that you're not at all interested in. So you're kind of looking at the ceiling and, you know, oh, there's this funny, you know, the sound baffling in this room has this sort of crazy fabric on it, and there's a big triangular thing in the corner, kind of looks like a kite, and there's all these crazy KABU stickers. And, you know, all around me there's this kind of cool stuff that, in the normal scheme of things, if I don't have a camera in my hand, I'm not paying any attention to. Mm-hmm. So you sort of learn to pay attention to these things. And it's one of the great joys of photography that I describe it as sort of like this giant potluck where Lee Friedlander teaches me what things he notices when he walks into a room, and Deanne Arbus teaches me what things she notices when she walks into a room, and Edward Weston teaches me what he notices when he walks into a room. And the more you study photography, the more channels you have on your TV, basically. I mean, mm-hmm. if you think about that metaphor of the TV, I mean, your TV receiver is only looking at one channel at a time because that's how it's set up. But the room around you is full of all those channels. Mm-hmm. The receiver is only noticing one at a time, but all those channels are there. TVs could be set up so that they receive all the signals at once. Mm-hmm. We just don't like that.
and you see encountering another artist as basically tuning into their channel.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I like I said, I describe it as like a potluck. It's like I'm going to bring something delicious to the potluck, and you're going to bring something delicious to the potluck. And instead of me only eating the food that I make, I get to try something that you made and that I never had before. And, ooh, this is exciting. And, ooh, this is tofu. Oh, this is so good, you know. So I think it's that kind of enrichment where we sort of if we think of it as a sort of a team sport, we're all out there finding what's beautiful in the world around us and coming back and reporting to the hive like bees do. I mean, a bee goes out and he finds, oh, there's some great clover over there, you know, and he goes back to the hive and he does a little dance that teaches the other bees where that clover was. And that's basically what I'm doing as a photographer. I'm going and finding some clover and coming back to the Elizabeth Leach Gallery and doing a little dance to show you where that clover is.
Mm-hmm. This is Joseph Gallivan on Art Focus. My guest today is Christopher Rauschenberg. His latest photographs are at the Elizabeth Leach Gallery through February the 2nd. In the other room at the gallery, there are prints, well, multiples, you call them, mm-hmm. By Robert Rauschenberg, your father. Tell me a bit about why he was attracted to that particular company that made them.
Yeah, they're prints from Gemini, which is a company in Los Angeles before them, Gemini and ULAE are two places that my dad made prints with a lot. And before them, printmaking was something that mostly happened like college professors, art professors at universities wearing their coats with the leather patches on the elbows, and they would make these little prints that were 4 by 6 inches and etchings and all those things. And I mean, I'm obviously exaggerating, but basically Gemini came in and they sort of said, well, what would you like to do? Do you want to make something 30 feet long? No problem. Do you want to make a rubber car? No problem. You know, what do you want to do? We'll make multiples and we can make it happen. And there was this wonderful sort of sense of anything the artist wants to do is possible that my dad was very attracted to. And he loved going down there working. And the whole atmosphere at Gemini is very collaborative, where the printers are really, they're not being subservient to the artist. They're like, hey, well, why don't we try this? We could do that. And they're really working as a team. And my dad loved that. My dad was driven by this huge level of curiosity. He was probably the most curious person I ever met. Mm-hmm. And the idea that somebody would come in and have another idea, and what about this way of doing it and everything, that was just great to him. That was exciting. You know, it's like, why would I only eat my own food at the potluck? What is this printer? Mm-hmm. What does he bring into the potluck, you know? And so some of the prints in the show are sort of more traditional lithographs in terms of technology. They're pretty straightforward technology. But then some of them are sewn together fabrics, and mm-hmm. I mean they're just whatever kind of crazy idea my dad had. Gemini was like, oh great, good idea.
The two that are fabric, they have this very brightly patterned fabric. Where is it from?
They're called the Samarkand stitches, and they're from Samarkand and former Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm. And You used to help your dad. You were in India, and
yeah, I went with him on a Gemini project where it was making two sets of multiples. Like, you could call them prints, but there's no printing presses anywhere near any of this. One was they make handmade paper in this city in India, in Ahmedabad. So we went to the Gandhi ashram where they made this paper, and they would make a piece of paper, and we would lay this bamboo framework on it, little pieces of fabric, and then it would fill. The paper makers would then pad on by hand a whole bunch more paper, so that the finished product, the artwork, was within the paper. It was a sandwich of paper, art, paper. And then also he was making sculptures that were made out of the kind of mud that people used to make their mud huts with, their houses with. Mm-hmm. And that mud, he said, you know, I want to do these things with mud, but, you know, they have to be archival because they're art, so maybe we could use like 100% rag paper pulp to make them. And he said, oh, yeah, that's what we use. I said, oh. Okay. And they have those ones, the mud ones, have turmeric in them, which makes them very aromatic. But that was traditional, but to keep the bugs from eating your house.
Mm-hmm. And you worked on basically cutting up pieces of sari fabric. Is that right?
Or yeah, those were, they were the using the big cutter machines at the factory. They cut these shapes that would fit into the different parts of this bamboo framework that my dad had sort of designed, and that they made enough of them for the prints. And so one of the prints is triangular. One of them is like this big sort of H with a whole bunch of smaller H's going across the top of it. And in each one of those little H pockets would be a different piece of fabric. And it was you. We were supposed to, our instruction as the workers on this was, you take the top one on the pile. You don't say, oh, well, this is blue and that's mm-hmm. green, so I'm not going to take that one. You take the top one on the pile, and it's mm-hmm. it's randomly however it is. Mm-hmm. And he was he was curious. He was interested in having each dish come out differently that he was bringing to the pile. Like each one should be its own thing. And even though it was a multiple, and many people, when they make multiples, they want each one to be exactly the same. But mm-hmm. he wanted each one to be sort of its own fresh self.
Mm-hmm. So you, it sounds like you and he have your own distinct points of view or worldview, you know, a kind of mature artistic vision. But you said as a kid, you know, you were on the bus and it was a kind of a telling moment.
Yeah, my mom and stepfather, I was sitting next to them on the bus, and this woman got on the bus. And one of my parents leaned over to the other one. I don't remember which one said it to who either at this point, but said, Rubens. And I didn't know who Rubens was, but I knew that Rubens was an artist, and that I knew that what they were doing was seeing this woman who just got on the bus as if she was a painting or a sculpture at the museum. Of course, now I know that she was probably kind of heavy and they were seeing her as a painting. But I got the general idea, even though I didn't know the specifics, that you could go to the museum while you're on the bus,
right?
While you're walking down the street, that you might see something on your way to the museum. You might see something more beautiful lying on the sidewalk than anything in the museum.
Mm-hmm.
I was once with Paul Sutton, who's the head of the art department out at Marylhurst. He and I were walking around in Soho, which is, that tells you it's a while ago because it was Soho instead of Chelsea, and we were looking at all these shows. And I said to Paul, you know, we certainly see a lot of good artwork, but I don't really see very much good sculpture. And why does it seem to be so hard to do good sculpture? As we were walking down the street talking about this, we walked by somebody, their hot dog had fallen out of its bun. It was just this hot dog lying on the sidewalk. And he and I looked down at this hot dog. We looked at each other and sort of shrugged and just walked on by. It's like, it's not so hard to make sculpture. That hot dog is a good sculpture.
Well, we have to wrap it up now. Thank you, Christopher Rauschenberg.
My pleasure.
Your pictures will be at the Elizabeth Leach Gallery through February the 2nd, and Robert Rauschenberg's prints will be there through March the 2nd. And I hope people go down and take a look at them because they're fascinating.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
KABU Radio is a proud media sponsor of the 28th annual Martin Luther King Day event. Keep Alive the Dream, an annual tribute to Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., produced by the World Arts Foundation. This year's event will take place at the New Beginnings Conference Center, 3300 Northeast 172nd Place in Portland, KABU will again broadcast the annual celebration in its entirety. More information about this live broadcast can be found at kabu.fm/2013MLK.
And now, the KABU News at Noon. Today, the Securities and Exchange Commission announced plans to require corporations to publicly disclose their political spending. This move came after a pressure campaign by citizens' rights group Common Cause. Currently, all other groups, including associations, unions, and individuals, are required to disclose their political campaign contributions. Only corporations are exempt from disclosure. The new rule by the SEC will increase the transparency of political spending by corporations. It will not, however, overturn the 2010 Supreme Court decision known as Citizens United, which has allowed corporations to spend unlimited amounts on political campaigns. A military judge will rule today on a motion to dismiss all charges against Army Private Bradley Manning, the alleged WikiLeaker. Legal experts say the motion has a very slim chance of succeeding. Manning is a former Army intelligence analyst accused of leaking secret war documents to WikiLeaks. His lawyers say that he was tortured because the military held him in a windowless cell for months as punishment for allegedly leaking the material to the website. Manning faces charges which include aiding the enemy and, if found guilty, could face life behind bars or execution. 160 residents of Hillsboro attended a public meeting introducing a proposed Walmart development in the western Portland suburb. A Walmart spokesperson says the development is in the planning stage, which is about listening and getting feedback. Attendees studied display boards detailing various aspects of the development, ranging from a traffic study to the possible color tones for the proposed store. The proposal, still in draft form, includes a 50,000-square-foot neighborhood store, two additional retail buildings, and a 242-unit apartment complex that will be north of the location. The site for the store is a 250-foot-acre parcel on the northeast side of the busy intersection of Southwest Baseline Road and Northwest Cornelius Pass Road in Hillsboro. 2 years ago, Walmart announced a plan to construct 17 stores in the Portland area and have faced strong opposition to this plan. Tune in every weekday.